This is side B of the first cassette.
Okay. So instead, I decided to, really to find out more about him. And actually, I'm, glad that I did because he and I developed what I consider is a pretty good relationship. I found out that one of his major areas of interest was mental health. And, I was on the Human Resources Committee, and also later Mental Health Study Commission after that session. But I found the areas in which he was interested and found areas in which we could work together. And, we sort of developed the type of relationship where he knew that there would be things that I would not support. I knew that there would be things he would not support. But where we could, we worked together. A couple of examples of where that happened. I guess one of the primary ones, you mentioned the Martin Luther King holiday bill. He is one of the persons that I had spoken with him. He's one of the persons that would be expected to be very much opposed to it, speak against it on the floor and so forth. But we talked about it, and ultimately, he decided that, I might not be able to vote for it. I probably will not be able to vote for it. But this was on a Friday or Thursday, and the vote was supposed to be up that following Monday. And he did come back and said, I'm not going to be able to vote for it. There, my people oppose that, but I'll not speak against it, So that in itself was a, major step as far as he's concerned. There are other issues that were, somewhat that would have been more controversial that we had similar discussions on. And, we just developed a relationship of mutual mm-hmm. respect and trust. And I think that's really important in terms of legislative activity, any other type of activity. It's not a wise idea to burn the bridges because there are many opportunities to cross bridges together with persons with whom you might be opposed. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of been, the hallmark. And that was probably one of my first impressions, which I think was a positive impression. So there were some negatives also, but I found it very difficult in terms, of, again, being taken seriously, being the only black member of the Senate at that time. Later on, the numbers did increase. And some friendships were formed. And it's just a matter of, this is something I think about in terms of when the issue about term limits comes up and so forth. It takes a while to develop the types of relationships in which people can really genuinely work together to get things done. Some people see that as a blight, on the system because they say if you work closely together, then you would tend not to necessarily oppose what the other wants to do as much, and therefore not being effective for whatever cause you're pursuing. But I look at it the other way. I think that anything that can be worked out among people by consensus oftentimes is going to be the best solution. Mm-hmm. So there were incidents later that, I remember when Monk Harrington ran for president pro tem of the Senate. I think that was 87, I don't recall now. And I did not support him. I supported Henson Barnes. And Monk did win. And, we had a few clashes and so forth. But as a result of the alliance that was formed, I guess, with the support for Henson, later on the next term, Henson did win as president pro tem and, you know, got a good committee assignment and a lot of things done. And I think that those are the types of things that have to be looked at in the political process. Everything that happens during one session is not going to be a good predictor of what's going to happen later.
Right. I see that we have probably about 15 minutes left, and I want to be sure to ask about a few things. And one of them was the story you told about your experience with Senator Harris suggests a question, and that's, I wonder about your sense of the how broad the possibility is for African Americans in the state legislature here in North Carolina to articulate a really truly different kind of political message, more attuned to the interests, say, of most black constituents and also, say, in economic terms, to a number of less privileged white voters in North Carolina. Do you feel there's actual room for that sort of message to be brought at least into the political debate? You mentioned how quickly he killed the death penalty bill. And
yes, I think that not only is there room for it, but I think it's an absolute necessity, really. And again, I think we have to look at the difference in the timing. At that time, again, that was not, okay, with being one black member of the Senate, there was not as much that could be done, such as one of the main areas of focus that I've had been educational equity, you know, students at risk issue, things along that line. And a lot of the things that I've been trying to get done, really, it took about 8 years before anything was really done. And there were a few other smaller things along the way, but it's necessary to enunciate the viewpoints that might not necessarily be as popular, because ultimately, if you work together with people, if there's enough support as far as public opinion later, there can be an impact. And so, you know, I'd say it's absolutely necessary. Otherwise, we don't even need to be here. You know, it could be a totally monolithic viewpoint represented within the General Assembly. If we don't take some positions that are different and that are supportive of the viewpoints that persons that don't have as strong a voice here hold, then I think that we're missing out on what is part of the major mission.
Do you think, how important, I want to ask about the Jingles case and reapportionment across the 80s. How important was Jingles in shifting the ground so that, I guess from your first experience in the Senate to say by the end of the decade, there would have been more chance, there were a greater number of black members here obviously, to speak with a more forceful voice on these kinds of issues. And I wonder just your broad sense of Jingles and reapportionment in helping that.
Well, I believe that that the reapportionment as it occurred was the, I guess, the driving factor that the changes would not otherwise have occurred, at least not within the foreseeable future. I guess the issue that probably is most dominant now, though, I guess focuses on the congressional situation, which whether or not it is good to have, say, the 1st and the 12th districts represented, as predominantly, the official phrase is majority-minority districts. And in terms of the impact that it's having on positions that are represented in the General Assembly, in terms of Democrat versus Republican, progressive versus liberal versus conservative, and the impact that the reapportionment, the redistricting has had upon that. And I think that while it's healthy to have the single member districts or even having multi-member districts in a manner that increases the likelihood of African-American, Native American representation, I think that it all has to be looked at, you know, in the context of what's the end result. I believe that one of the things that, if we feel possible to fine-tune things, one of the things that, in my opinion, that could be done or could have been done might have been to make some of the percentages lower and therefore having more of an impact in certain other surrounding districts, but yet still allowing enough that offered a good opportunity for minority representation. How all that's going to work out in the end, I don't know, because we might end up having to revisit that issue.
Let me ask a few questions about the party realignment that, that has occurred in the state here. First, I wonder in setting up the context for those kinds of questions, if you can tell me generally about the nature of Democratic Party leadership across the decade of the 80s. I'm thinking about folks like Monk Harrington and Henson Barnes in the Senate and Liston Ramsey, and then, well, I guess the Joe Mavretic elevation is very much caught up in what we're discussing here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you mean Democratic leadership within the General Assembly,
right,
or are you talking about generally? What?
And okay. And party leadership under of course, Jim Martin's in the governor's seat then, but
Bob Jordan
and so forth. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, I'm trying to set up the question, how much do you think or not Democratic Party leadership anticipated the coming change? A sense of your perspective on how well or not the Democratic Party leadership anticipated the shifting ground.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think that it was anticipated. Well, let me ask you one question. Are you referring to the last election, or you're talking about over a period of time?
Even over the period of time, because, of course, in 84, there are a few more Republicans elected. By 88, there are really now enough of them in the General Assembly. That,
Okay, I believe that looking at it over a period of time, I think that it was anticipated that there would be, you know, that there would be change, that there would be more Republican representation, partially because of you know, changing demographics within the state. And, excuse me just a second.
Sure.
That might be. And then also, you know, the national, just, I guess, sort of the national attitude and so forth, too. But I think that, I believe that generally what happened in this last election, I think, came as more of a surprise in terms of the magnitude of it. I think that it was probably anticipated that Republicans would pick up some seats, but I don't think it was anticipated that there would be enough so that Democrats would lose control of the House or have such a small margin in the Senate. And I believe that a lot of this is due to the fact that the message of the Republican Party, particularly the right wing of the Republican Party, is getting out quite well nationally. And they have picked up upon things that from, I guess, a marketing standpoint, that can be used to, you know, create higher levels of dissatisfaction with the persons who were in power. And through the whether it's the radio talk shows or whatever. There are so many means. The Democratic Party has been very lax in doing that in terms of getting messages out and in terms of countering messages. And it's not an easy thing to do. But I believe that the fact that this had not been done is the reason for the broad sweep that did occur. And whether or not there can be enough of an effort between now and 96 to really get a solid message out, to get people to understand what's going on, to get people to understand that some of the things that the Republican Party is claiming credit for that are positive are really ideas that had been promoted through Democrats. All of these things, and also looking at, I think the key issues, again, is going to be looking at what, okay, not the question that was posed, I guess, during the Reagan administration, the Bush administration, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? But I think we have to focus things more on, given the state of events, the policies that are emerging, are your children going to be better off 10 years, 20 years from now? You know, and I think there's going to be a need in changing the focus, not looking at what looks good, feels good, sounds good politically today, but what's going to be the long-range consequence of these actions. And I think that's what will have to be done in order to forestall what's going on or to turn around what's going on.
Recalling, just to pick maybe a couple of the more dramatic examples of this phenomenon, recalling, say, the 84 Hunt-Helms race and the 1990 Gantt-Helms race and the use of the 32nd spot by Jesse Helms in those campaigns, do you think the voters are persuadable given the way that electioneering is conducted these days, with electronic media being such a big part of it?
I don't think that voters are persuadable from the standpoint of really looking in depth at issues and the long-range impact. I don't think they are persuadable by the typical means that would be used in campaigns. It's hard to fight the 30-second sound bites and things along that line. I think what's going to be needed is the development, not just during the course of an election period, but a year-round constant process of getting citizens of North Carolina to feel more involved in that, in fact, they are a part of government, that government is not them, government is us, you know. And that's what's going to have to be done. And in order to turn things around, I believe. It's not going to be done through counter-advertising, because that will make people possibly even more unsure, more confused, just conflicting messages. And when there are conflicting messages, apathy develops and frustration develops, and then you see who you can lash out against. But there's a different approach that's going to have to be taken if we're going to change things.
Before talking about a number of the issues that you've been very much involved in a little more detail, I just want to ask about the history and experiences of the Legislative Black Caucus across your tenure here in Raleigh. If you can kind of sketch out your perspective on how the Legislative Black Caucus's experience has unfolded.
Okay, the caucus actually officially was started in 80-81 term, at the end of the 80-81 term, primarily Dan Blue, Ken Spaulding. Before, when I was elected to take office, in 82, '83-'84 session, there were some, Ken and Dan, you know, called some meetings, called people together. So I guess really, in terms of being a functional caucus, it was formed at that time. So for 83, 84, again, as I said, there was a critical mass for the first time. As I said, I believe the number was 13, but I'm not sure. And immediately we did begin having some impact. One of the things that we did adopt as a major agenda item and concern, which continues to this day, is the support financially and otherwise of the 5 public historically black institutions within the university system. And during that first session after the caucus was fully formed, 83-84, that was an immediate impact. At the end of this, although it was not done in a in a manner of progression, at the very end of the session, we realized that in the budget that was proposed, there was nothing in there, capital budget, for any of the historically black campuses, sort of like what came out of the House this time. And so on that last day, the day before, it was anticipated that there would be adjournment, or 2 days before, we had a meeting with the leadership of the House and the Senate. And there was, we're told that, there's just nothing that can be done. There's just no more money left. But after that meeting, they did find $12 million, and that was, I guess, one of the first things. A lot of the emphasis during those first years had been on education in the higher ed system. One of the issues that we undertook, I guess, was Bill Friday, of course, was still president then. And I think 85, I believe it was, when there was the discussion about substantially limiting the number of out-of-state students and requiring them to cut back by that next year, having more than 15% out-of-state students. We took that battle on because we felt that, first of all, not only some of the historical black institutions, but some of the other institutions, I don't remember offhand which ones they would be very drastically affected by this. And, going from the standpoint that it's good to have a good mix of students from in-state and out-of-state, the thing that brought this on was the idea that North Carolina taxpayers shouldn't be subsidizing the education of students out-of-state. Our position was that students from out-of-state, so many, not only draw other people to North Carolina, but so many of them stay here after graduation or leave and then ultimately end up coming back, therefore benefiting the state, the body of knowledge, and the economy. We were able to get some delays, some staggering on that, and it ended up being, system-wide 18%, I think. Things like that, plus later on there was more involvement in the economic development, the community development corporations primarily, and support of other entities such as that. A lot of that occurred during the time that, that Bob Jordan was lieutenant governor. We got a great deal of support from him on that, on the Senate side. And so those have been some of the major items that have always been the focus. Others, it tends to vary from one year to another, but those are the consistent ones, education and economic development.
Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, how would you describe the relationship of the Black Caucus to the leadership of the Democratic Party? You mentioned just a moment ago that Jordan was very supportive.
Yeah, I think that there has been a good relationship. That was a good relationship from the time that Bob Jordan was lieutenant governor up through the present time, on the Senate side. And on the House side, of course, there was a good relationship. There were several members, including Dan Blue, Herman Giss, a number of the others that had good, very good relationships with Liston Ramsey and Martin Nesbitt and others, and Billy Watkins. And so it was a matter of developing those relationships. Mm-hmm. And then later, of course, when Dan was speaker, you know, and I don't know how it is in the House right now. Things are somewhat strained, of course, and it's not a lot as directly that they can get done, but there are still some possibilities on certain issues from time to time. Mm-hmm. But generally, there has been a good relationship.
Mm-hmm. Early on, in the first few years of the caucus, when Jimmy Green was lieutenant governor, would that have been a little different? Because I'm remembering, for example, that Jimmy Green's race in 76, in his first four-year lieutenant governorship term, his mm-hmm. race against Howard Lee, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. where there were certain racial appeals made by Green in that campaign.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would have probably, it would have been more difficult, but I don't necessarily think insurmountable. In other words, had Jimmy Green come along a few years later, when there was a larger number of African Americans represented in the Senate, I think that, and if there had been competition, if he had planned on entering other races and things like that, I think there could have been some impact. But definitely, the relationship would not have been as good as it was, say, with Bob Jordan on the House side, like with Liston Ramsey.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Tell me about, if you would, about black politics in the years when Dan Blue, Speaker of the House, mm-hmm. how things looked over here in those couple of years.
Well, again, there was a lot that was accomplished. Going back again to the issue about college, higher education, that the fact that Dan was speaker made a big difference in terms of the way that the bond issue looked, made a big issue in terms of support for programs that focus on prevention mm-hmm. and intervention as opposed to correction. You know, it was, in my opinion, an enlightened period of time, and particularly when you look back at it from today's perspective. So I think it had a tremendous impact. And then also there were, one of the side benefits of it, I guess, was the fact that being only the second elected Speaker of the House that was African American in the nation, that gave him a great deal of visibility, which also helped, you know, not only here, but, you know, nationally. I believe that it was a very, you know, very positive benefit arose from it.
Mm-hmm. One last question before we move on to these final set of questions about some of the issues you've been directly involved with here. If you had to point to certain key Republican Party leaders who've been most responsible mm-hmm. for the GOP's success in the last decade or so, who would those be and why?
Hmm.
Or do you think a shift sort of transcends personality?
Okay. Well, naturally, you can't discuss that without mentioning the impact of Jesse Helms. I think that by virtue of some of the momentum that was developed while Jim Martin was in office, I think that he would have to be mentioned. The momentum that was developed when Holzhauser was in office was not nearly as strong, nor were the conditions as conducive. But under Jim Martin, he pulled a number of people into state government and into the political arena that I believe had more staying power, so to speak. You'd have to look at it, too, in terms of contributions made, say, by Phil Kirk and the through the business community with his leadership of excuse me, North Carolina Systems for Business and Industry. And that has been a more reasoned evolution of involvement, I think, as opposed to the more radical, as would be espoused by some of the other leaders in the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that gives a stronger sense to some of the business community. I believe that as far as General Assembly members, that might have had a big impact. One person who has worked very hard over the years has been Bob Shaw. It's difficult to sort of single out the personalities there, you know. And actually, in my opinion, the persons that are probably most responsible are not necessarily persons who are or have been elected officials, you know. And therefore, it makes them less easily identified.
Who comes to mind in that regard?
Well, I'm not sure who to name on that. One, of course, had been, I think, Bob Bradshaw. And I'm sure that there are others that would be, say, business leaders and so forth that have been very influential in pulling it together. That I've not really examined it to determine who they are. But I guess the main point that I'm trying to make is that perhaps some of the persons that are most responsible are not necessarily directly visible within the political arena.
Right. Let me conclude here with some questions about certain of the key policy issues you've been quite interested in during your tenure here in Raleigh, and the ways in which certain cultural or aspects of cultural politics, if you will, mm-hmm. have reverberated as these issues have been discussed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of issues where where race is a factor in the wide political equation as these things get sorted out. To begin, specific items including the King holiday, your effort to...
That's okay, go ahead. Okay.
Your effort, I know you proposed, for example, that the state establish an African-American heritage or historical heritage
state
commission.
Historic site.
Beg your pardon?
Oh, I'm sorry, I thought the state historic site. You're talking about that?
My understanding was you had also proposed that a permanent commission be established.
Oh, okay.
That's correct, is it?
Looking at tying it in with tourism and so forth.
That's right.
Yes.
Right.
Uh-huh.
And then also the, you of course were instrumental in. Of course, you were also instrumental in bringing the legislation that resulted in the school merger and restructuring the county commission down in Guilford County.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe if you can kind of take me through those sorts of issues and experiences here in the legislature, in the Senate, and share your perspective on how those issues unfolded.
Okay, well, in terms of the cultural issue, I think that would go back to one. I guess my first involvement in that was the legislation that ultimately ended in the creation of the Charlotte Hawkins Brown State Historic Site. Mm-hmm. And it first started off with in the days when we had identifiable pork barrel, you know. It started off with a, you know, for local organizations and so forth. It started off with an allocation of money to do a feasibility study for the establishment of the site. There had not previously been a historic site that focused on the achievements of African Americans, nor of a woman. And again, the momentum for this occurred during the time that Bob Jordan was lieutenant governor. And as I said, you know, we did have a close relationship, and he was very helpful and supportive. So we did get that the study back that showed that it should be done, and ultimately was developed. It's not gone as far as it should because it's not gotten the type of resources that's needed for improving the infrastructure to really develop a good visitorship. So we have a lot of work to do there, but at least it's there. The reason was that I felt that in if the state, through its historic site structure, is to show events, developments, attitudes, so forth, within the state from a historical perspective, it would be remiss in leaving out the contributions of African Americans. The only other way that they're shown is on some sites, like slave shacks or something along that line, preparing African Americans during that period of slavery, and nothing else. And so this was focused primarily upon educational achievements. later, there was a strong focus. In recent years, there's been a strong focus in North Carolina on tourism, the tourism industry. And one of the things, again, that has been missing from the whole matrix there has been those sites, those historic places, events that can draw more tourism with a focus upon the African American community. That was the purpose of the commission, to look at that. There's much more that needs to be done in that area. One of the things that I envision is a network tying together various places of interest and historic sites in North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, Georgia particularly, and even nationally, that can be considered as a tour that people want to take and tie it in with other events. And I think that could be a great statement for North Carolina, plus a tremendous benefit from an economic tourism standpoint. You mentioned, outside of the cultural realm, you mentioned the school merger and the commissioner redistricting. The school merger battle is one that had gone on in Guilford County for quite some time. I think back in, the years are running together, but during the early 80s to mid 80s, there was a task force established to look at merger. There was a contract with Research Triangle Institute, sort of as consultant to that. The report came back really recommending merger, but since there were three systems there, it was a very difficult situation to achieve. And finally, there was legislation that was introduced. I think Mary Seymour was the primary introducer in the Senate, and I think Al Lineberry, if I remember correctly, in the House. And during that time, I was not comfortable with it because I didn't feel that there had been enough community involvement in the issue and that it had not been debated to the point where there could be a greater consensus developed, and also felt that there were certain things that should be spelled out in the legislation that were not. And so, in essence, that was stalled. But the next year we came back, we had meetings with community organizations, the chamber, school system, primarily Greensboro and High Point. The county didn't want any part of it. And we developed another piece of legislation, which I introduced, and Herman Gist, I think, introduced on the House side. And as a part of the deliberations, we felt that it was important to have this legislation speak to what would happen in a way that could allay some of the fears and some of the concerns of people, answer some of the questions, that were floating out there in the community, such as when students would be assigned to different schools, and such as some control over the cost, administration, things along that line, so that we included. One other really important thing was the issue about how it would be governed. How would the districts be drawn? And actually, some of us sat down and drew up some plans. We tried to come up with with a smaller number of districts. We tried to come up with seven seats or nine seats. And one of the things that I really wanted to do is to try to get it set up in a manner that each one of the county, the outlying county, High Point and Greensboro would be equitably represented in terms of based upon population and so forth. Also, from a racial standpoint, there would be equitable representation based upon the racial makeup of the county. And in order to do this, the smallest number we could come up with was nine districts and two at large. Felt the at large was important to bring, have somebody in there that could help bring a consensus that had to be represented by, that was elected by everybody within the county. And so that's what we ended up with. And then, although it's not portrayed this way, and it wasn't portrayed this way in the lawsuit, Hathi Herman and I talked about redistricting of the county commissioners against their will at that time. It was under the control of Republican majority led by Steve Arnold, who now is a candidate for governor. But in any event, I felt that it would be a good thing to try to have a system of representation on the county commissioners that was consistent with the school board, and at least have one instance where the boundaries for two different elections are the same, so people could get to know their representatives better. And also, I looked at it from the standpoint that part of the county's budget, the greater part, focuses on education. Mm-hmm. So therefore, the person representing a district on the county commissioners, and the person representing the district on the school board should have a similar constituency. And so this was accomplished. And so therefore, what we did was impose the school board system upon the county commissioners. And of course, it had been portrayed as a way to get rid of the Republican county commissioners, and that it was designed to do that, but it was not. The idea was to make it consistent with the school. Mm-hmm. And we developed the school without even looking at who held what seats in the county commissioners and things like that. Mm-hmm. One of the other things we tried to do, there were suggestions that we have some districts that were predominantly black that had higher numbers. I felt that, as I alluded to earlier, that was unnecessary, and I felt that if we had lower numbers, it would be better, and then we could still get a more equitable distribution. Mm-hmm. And there was one district particularly that, when the lawsuit was filed by the Republican, there was an allegation that this particular district, which was in High Point, which was a 51% black, violated the Voting Rights Act, in that it did not provide adequate minority representation, and that others should have been higher. So we did prevail. And when I configured that district, I did it based upon the numbers in the Hunt-Helms race you mentioned, and in the Gant-Helms race, and some of the statewide elections, to seeing what the voting patterns had been. And I was convinced that that was a district, that 51% black district, in which there was a reasonable chance of minority representation. And so on the county commissioners and on the school board, that has proven to be true.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let me ask about your, you were the Senate floor leader in the effort to secure the Martin Luther King holiday. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you
So we had two Martin Luther King holiday bills. One was establishing the holiday, and one was making it a state holiday. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And during the first one, which was in 83, I was 84, 83, I think it was, during the long session. That was my first term there. I knew to it and everything. So the person that was extremely beneficial in that, again, was Henson Barnes. And without his help, would not have gotten it through the Senate. The second time, when we made it the state holiday, that was a paid state holiday for employees. That's the one that I made the reference to Ollie Harris, what we had worked out on that. Mm-hmm. And the major concern that some people had later was whether or not state employees would choose that as a holiday and not have Veterans Day. So that's a compromise that Ollie Harris and Bob Warren and myself and a few others worked out. And so really we didn't have, if we got that worked out, there really wasn't any real opposition. Mm-hmm. There were a few folks that spoke in opposition to it, but not nearly as vehemently as happened in the House. As a matter of fact, I mentioned Steve Arnold. When he was in the House at that time, and he and others spoke in the House about Martin Luther King being a communist, and it's terrible to recognize him or anything along that line. We didn't have that type in the situation at the Senate that time.